The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. We've made it to the end of the international break. And how? Harry Kane kicks a football with such purity that we should really just talk about it for an hour. Mind you, these modern balls do move about a bit, like a shoot size five. But what does it matter if Gareth Southgate won't make any substitutions? There's fury as he fails to force the fourth official into getting his electric board out as Poland equalise late on against 11 tired starters. Meanwhile, hope for Fitbar Scotland win in Austria. It's in their hands. Nothing can go wrong. We'll round up the rest of the qualifiers, look ahead to the Premier League fixtures, a Brazilian-less special. A CONMEBALL's up. What will it mean? Also, Ronaldo's back, but no one can watch him on TV. Will anybody cope? There's all that, some hard-nosed non-league recruitment, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Liu, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very good. Hi, Fred Carruthers.
Hi there, Max Rushton.
And hello, Rory Smith from the New York Times.
Hello, Max.
Shall we start in Warsaw? Poland won, England won. Faye, a good point for England, a fair result? What do you think?
Probably on the balance of the game, it was a fair result, but I think England will be disappointed. In fact, I know they're disappointed about it because to concede so late on, and there had been, it was a really niggly, nasty game, all in all, I think. I think Poland did a really good job on England in that way, trying to wind them up, putting tackles in everywhere. And I think Gareth Southgate's going to be disappointed that they didn't hold on for that lead, just a momentary lapse in concentration from Kyle Walker. And these kind of things happen. I mean, it's not a disaster for qualification, but, you know, they had records that they wanted. And, you know, the momentum that, you know, winning six in a row in qualification brings going into, you know, the final four matches would have really helped. But the final four matches are relatively, and I hate saying this and I'm sorry, I've got my own complacency that Gareth Southgate has warned against, but it very much feels as if the last four qualifiers will be pretty straightforward for them. So I think qualification is pretty much sealed, but they've just got a little bit more pressure on them that they wouldn't have had.
Rory, how much did you enjoy the way Harry Kane kicked the football?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Just kicking the football and putting it where you want to go. I'm not massively... Wojciech Szczęsny's had quite a bad start to the season. I'm not 100% certain that he'll be delighted to watch that one back. But yeah, I mean, Kane scores goals. It was a good kick match. That is my in-depth analysis of Harry Kane's kick. It was good.
What's that? What do you call it? Like a, you know, when they line up the free kick on the valve, like a knuckle ball. Is that what it is?
Well, so
that's a cricketing term, isn't it?
No, the knuckle ball is a baseball term, which was adopted for the Ronaldo free kick, which I always assumed was to do with the part of his foot that he was hitting it with, not where on the ball he was connecting. But you might be right. It might be related to the valve. So yeah, I suppose you could describe. You don't really get knuckle balls within open play. It's a set piece thing, the knuckle ball. Maybe Harry Kane. Maybe that's Harry Kane's great development, is that he's worked out a way of knowing exactly where the valve is on the ball at all times.
What did you make of the game, Johnny?
It was all right. It was quite a good game, I thought, and for a game without much, I suppose, jeopardy in it, because England are kind of through. You know, they've got Andorra and like, everyone's got to play Andorra and San Marino and Albania. Poland are still quite strongly fancied to go through as well, I think. For all that, it was pretty competitive and quite, you know, tactically intriguing. And yeah, just that late twist of drama at the end. I thought England were fine, actually. I thought they started quite well. They were kind of patient and they were, they didn't, you know, I think Poland tried to get in their grill a bit, and I thought they handled that all right. And then, you know, they conceded a goal at the end. It happens. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Southgate's substitutions and or lack of substitutions going, you know, I think first time since Euro 96 semi-final, they went a full game without making any substitutions, which, you know, I guess that's a separate issue. I think a lot of people are linking that to the defeat in a way that doesn't quite make sense to me. I mean, the players on the pitch should be able to defend a pretty simple cross into the area, and they didn't. They just kind of collapsed on themselves and got a little bit narrow. So yeah, there's two slightly separate issues there. There's, you know, the substitutions that people are getting really angry about, because somebody must always be getting really angry about something after England game, and you know, that kind of late sucker punch, which I think was disappointing, but in a slightly different way.
But there is such fury. I mean, maybe we should just never look at social media, but, you know, Sean's saying, I cannot believe the hype over Southgate. The wins are against teams we always win against. When we play anyone half decent, we always underperform and fall short. We will win nothing with Southgate in charge. He got to a penalty shootout in a final. Like, no one in the Euros, have they ever done that before? The Ole Gunnar Solskjaer of international football, who's saying, should we start to question England's game plan when they have a 1-0 lead against a decent team? Time and time again, Southgate either makes no changes or changes too late and we lose the lead. Why ignore the bench? Faye, are you furious?
No, I don't get furious about many things, to be honest, which is probably why I should never, ever go on social media. I think, having listened to Gareth Southgate speaking post-match, I think the final played on his mind a little bit, because he was criticised for bringing on Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford really late in extra time, and they weren't up to the speed of the game. Marcus Rashford at one point was playing at right back, but he'd brought them on for the penalties. But I think he's assessed that, and so he looked at it on the balance and thought, do you know what, we're doing okay. He was looking at changing the wingers right at the end and bringing on replacements for Grealish and Sterling, but ultimately then they conceded, so he didn't need to. But I don't think it's one of those in-game management things that you don't know until you're involved in it what the best thing to do, and perhaps the snap decisions are something that he and Steve Holland and his coaching team need to work on a little bit more, because Poland was starting to turn the screw a little bit, and you perhaps needed some fresh legs. But I think it's one of those things again. Perhaps I would be more frustrated by it if there was more riding on the game. I don't quite understand why everybody's so, you know, adamantly furious about it.
Is it not because we've got so used as like a football culture to fretting about England, and there's not really anything to fret about anymore? And it feels like, this happened during the Euros a lot, that there were these kind of debates that were started, and the media are kind of complicit in this, but they happen organically among fans as well, that you get these debates, but you sort of think, well, look, these debates don't matter. So there was the debate over which right back he should leave out. You know, how many of the right backs should Southgate take? Does Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier and Trent Alexander-Arnold, does Gareth have to take him? And it was dressed up in these in this tone as though like there was some kind of consequence to that decision. Whereas in
showdown,
reality, exactly, like it was kind of, you know, the fate of the world might hang on how many right backs Gareth Southgate does or doesn't take to the Euros. Whereas in reality, it was quite a complex and quite a nuanced subject, and there was a variety of like valid opinions. And if you throw in the fact that there's not much to worry about with England, they're basically pretty good, and the general sort of timber of social media, what you get is this sense of urgency and outrage, and isn't everything awful? Southgate probably should have made a couple of subs last night. His rationale for not doing it kind of makes sense, that they're in control. If you bring, it's the same with transfers. Like we always assume that every transfer works out perfectly, and the player that's moved for big money or joined the new team is going to be an outright success. We always assume that substitutes influence the game for the better. They don't. Sometimes you bring on a substitute and it ruins your balance, or it costs you control, or they don't play very well. Then they don't get up to the speed of the game. And I think there was just this sort of assumption that had he brought on substitutes, it would have improved things. It might not have done. It might have made no difference whatsoever. It might have made things worse. And in lieu of anything else to actually worry about, like losing a game or potentially not qualifying for a tournament, we sort of focus on that as the issue, because there has to be an issue with England. We don't really know what to do with they're pretty good. That's not... No one's gonna click on that.
No, there's an interesting point you make as well about criticism of in-game management, because it's always done with hindsight. Like it's very, you know, it's a bit like a manager brings on a substitute who immediately scores. There's sort of a lot of luck in that as well. I mean, obviously there's more than just pure luck in being a football manager, Johnny, but the sort of criticism of in-game management is it's difficult, because it's always this: you didn't do this and they lost the game, and maybe you did do some things and it did affect things in a different way. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I remember during the Euro final, you know, it was about 25 minutes in, and everyone was saying, well, you know, Italy are done here. Italy are absolutely, they're done, they're frazzled. And I was pretty much the only person, I would say I was the first person at Wembley Stadium that night to spot that something was going wrong. This is not working. He's got to change something. Not necessarily a sub, but, you know, he's got to get them further up the pitch. He's got to instill something in them. He's got to change it up somehow. Because, you know, surely everyone could see the way this was going. And no, it's coming home. And everyone is sort of, so, you know, there is that, but there is also the kind of the I told you so, metric, which is incalculable. I thought there is this idea that England are really, really bad at sitting on leads or holding on to leads, which is something I wrote about before the Euros, actually. They do it less than pretty much any major nation. And you know, we saw it again during the Euros. It didn't really feel like one of those. What kind of minute did Kane score? Like 77 or something?
72.
So, you know, it's not one of those kind of quintessential England leads where they score too early and they just get pushed further and further back and there's this crushing inevitability about it. This felt a bit more like a sucker punch. I mean, I thought, you know, as they go into 89, 90 minutes, to me, they felt fairly comfortable. I mean, Poland had a bit of the ball, but I didn't feel like there was a goal coming. And then, you know, a goal came.
But that's the other thing, is that we always forget that there's two teams on the pitch and they're both trying to do something. So some of the time, and Johnny's right.
I refuse to believe that.
Refuse to acknowledge that. It's like England aren't exclusively, or like, and it applies to big English clubs as well when they play other teams, as they tend to. Like, they're not exclusively in control of the outcome. Like, the other team is allowed to do stuff as well. So as Johnny says, like, Poland had a bit of the ball. That's just the Poles are trying. So,
yeah, I've thought that for so long. Like, this idea, and it is so true that when you are watching your team, that the other team are just a supporting cast. They're not really, they're sort of extras. So if any time you score a goal, it's because your team have done something good. And every time you concede, it's your team have made a mistake. And you sort of ignore that. Yeah, like you say, Rory, it's 11 people. Really, that's all they're trying to do at that time. In that's literally their only interest is stopping you doing what you want to do. It's an important part.
I don't think
of football.
You could call Kamil Glick an extra in that. He was the pantomime villain, I would say,
no.
For most of the game.
What happened there, Faye? Do we know what happened?
I've tried to get clarification from the FA, and they're not really saying anything other than what the pictures showed, which was Kamil Glick kind of playing with the chin of Kyle Walker, which seemed to... Kyle Walker reacted very calmly to it, but there must have been something...
Like a little tickle,
yeah,
like a sort of...
No, it was a pinch.
Did he have a buttercup?
was he calling him a liar in the schoolyard 1980
fashion? Chinny
chin. Chinny record.
Oh, 90s school playground. Yeah, it was a really odd thing to do.
Good on you, Faye, for seeking clarification from the FA. I was just wandering around having a coffee, just waiting to find out.
It's kind of my job, Max.
Lucky some people are actual journalists here. Johnny, you wrote a piece about Robin Lewandowski, about being a sort of the plight of the one man nation.
Yeah, I mean, I find it, because, you know, you only really find this in international football, because in club football, everybody kind of finds a club that is appropriate to their level of ability. And in international football, there, you know, you obviously you don't have that. You're stuck with what you have. And so there's this, I find it incredibly sort of stirring, seeing one guy surrounded by Not necessarily useless players, but players who are nowhere near his standard, just trying to rouse them. And you know, you see this with Gareth Bale playing for Wales, and it needs a certain kind of player as well, because, you know, Giggs wasn't up to it. Giggs didn't fancy it that much. You know, I'm never sure Mkhitaryan fancied it that much with Armenia. He's not that sort of player. But you know, Pandev at the Euros with North Macedonia, there's something really kind of, you know, and Lewandowski, who's been doing this for 13, 14 years now, and I think he scored something like 30 more goals than anyone else who's ever played for Poland. And it's just so, you know, so much better than everyone. And you can see it now because the way that all the play seems to go through him and all these quite good players that are surrounding him, they just kind of, they pass it to him, even though he doesn't really want it. And so just him being there has kind of created this immense center of gravity and in that team. And I thought, he's kind of used to it now and he deals with it so well. He's everywhere. He's number 10, he's number 9, he's kind of tackling and chasing back and scoring and assisting. It's kind of one man tour de force. You don't really see that so much that often in club football.
When I first heard the commentators, I thought they'd put him up front with Adam Buxton, which I thought, I know he's good, Lewandowski, but Adam Buxton there, just podding away with his dog, just wandering around the field going, yeah, I'll play up front for Poland for a game. Why not? Only one other question from the England game. Adam says, I think Kyle Walker would get into a World 11. I mean, he wrote this before Kyle Walker just was sold, might be like a really obvious dummy. I don't think any other England player would. Am I right on both? If not, who replaces Walker or which England player makes the 11? Rory.
I'm biased. I take his point completely. I think that Kyle Walker is in a weird way for a player who's cost as much money as he has twice and has won as many England caps and Premier League titles. I think Kyle Walker is probably overlooked a little bit in terms of the level of his quality. But I would, if I was picking my World 11 and had a right back, it would be Achraf Hakimi of PSG, who I think is the best right back in the world. So he wouldn't get in my World 11, but the point is a sound one.
But how many right backs would you pick in your?
I would make sure to have a squad that contained at least four, just in case people shouted at me.
Kimmich would probably be, a good shout as an auxiliary right back, but somewhere you could play somewhere else.
Oh, thanks for answering those questions. That'll do for part one. Part two, Barca Jim will join us. Not a despondent, a hopeful Scot. But we'll chat to him in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barca Jim says, Scotland being the only home nation to win. Is this a signifier of the coming apocalypse? Let's ask him now. He joins us on his tour of the car parks of the north. What he does there, that is his business entirely. Jim Burke, how are you?
How you doing, Max? All right? All good?
Yeah, very good. Big 1-0 win away at Austria. That was Andy Hunter saying, look, this was the perfect night for Scotland. Tense, exhausting, yet perfect.
It was all of those things and a bit more besides. Thankfully, I'm kind of on a no drink during the week kind of thing because I would have got through about 8 cans in that last 20 minutes. It was incredibly tense. But at the same time, I didn't feel, if it's a bizarre thing, I always worried, but I actually felt that we had it, But obviously, I'm never going to verbalise that because that's the law, you can't do that. It's like saying, if we can only get to half time, that never works. As soon as somebody says it out loud, then that breaks the fourth wall, But no, I thought we looked great and we deserved to win, I thought. The big problem we've got quality in a lot of positions, but the position to make me confident would be with the guy with number 9 in the back. And we're just not good enough up front to make me be confident about actually getting to the World Cup finals. But it's in our own hands, and that's brilliant.
Che Adams does show the sort of quality that he could be. He is a step above sort of the Lyndon Dykes and the Kiefer Moore sort of, classic small country, big, tall centre-forward type thing.
He is, but Max, we're in a situation. I was speaking to one of my pals about it, and we're in a situation where we've got strikers that need 3 chances to get 1 goal, yeah? And when you're Scotland and you're playing better opponents, getting those 3 chances at times is a big ask. Like I said, the Wales have got Bale, England have got Kane. If they get 2 chances, one of them's definitely going in. Once you get to top levels of the game, that's the difference between success and failure, is that you got 2 chances, you got a goal.
Stephen O'Donnell had the run of David Alaba by the end. What's that about?
I know. To be fair, that chance in the second half, if I could have picked one name out of the hat not to have that chance, it would be Stephen O'Donnell. But he did brilliantly. He did absolutely brilliant. But that's Steve Clarke's ability. He is to put together players that become, especially defensively, that become greater than the sum of the parts.
Felt to me like, you know, those NFL running, you know, when like a linebacker accidentally gets the ball and then scores a touchdown and then has to have oxygen for the next like 3 weeks. It was sort of like he was so far up the pitch, he was sort of slightly confused about what was happening. I mean, look, it is in your hands, Jim, isn't it? I mean, that is, and you know, you almost never play Israel. So like, what a dream that is.
You know, they have the unknown quantity, Max. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, we just don't know what we're doing. But we've got them at home. I think we're Faroe Islands away the next two games, and then Moldova, and then our last game's Denmark at home, who you think, hopefully, are going to send their under-14s. You know, if they've got anything about them, they'll send their under-14s for the last game. And yeah, we couldn't ask for any more. We had to win that game. We won it. We won it with a degree of certainty. And yeah, I am unusually buoyant and happy.
You just sound surprised. I mean, the high point of the game was the Austrian keeper, Daniel Backman, kicking the ground and collapsing. It was very upsetting that Scotland didn't score off the back of that, because then, you know, it was just, it was basically like taking a massive divot with a 7-iron, wasn't it? It was absolutely beautiful to see. I can't be passive aggressive. I can't be patronising. I can only say well done, Jim. I've run out of things to ask you.
And as I say, this will be the one and only time on a Guardian podcast where the Scottish person is the one who's talking about an away victory in Europe. And this is just, I think this is a blue plaque moment, to be perfectly honest with you.
We'll erect a plaque. Thanks for coming on. What car park are you in, just in case anyone's passing?
No, I'm in Levenshulme, which is a leafy suburb of Manchester. Well, it's good bits and bad bits of it. But yes, it's all good.
Oh, well, if you're passing and you see Jim there, do say hello. Cheers, mate.
Good man. Thanks, Max. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Jim Burke there, Pastor Jim, one of our Scotland correspondents. Simon says, are we talking enough about Denmark and their incredible form? I feel like there is a genuine chance of them reaching the semi-final in the next World Cup. Be aware that we've had a real spike in Danish audience since the Euros. So I mean, Rory, once again, you can be honest. They won't be upset, but they have a momentum. And they were actually quite unlucky in that semi-final as well, I thought, against us.
Yeah, your Scandies generally are quite a good audience. We at the New York Times do really well whenever we write about Norway. Anything about Norway, just loads of Norwegians read us. So it always pays to be nice about the Nordics. That's my general policy in life. But what Denmark have done is amazing. I mean, to obviously, qualifying groups can be a bit weird. So obviously they've got the Faroes and Moldova, who, you know, are not... The Faroes aren't bad, but they, you know, Moldova are not the toughest opposition in the world. Scotland, Israel, Austria, kind of that sort of middle tier of teams. So the Danes, they don't have a giant in their group or anything, but to win all six, to score 22 and concede none, it's not bad. And obviously to get to the semi-finals of the Euros at the same time, and I think they've been on this run of form since before Hjulmand took charge. In fact, they went 34 without losing or something before he took charge under his predecessor. There is a core of a good team there that works well together. They've been together a reasonably long time with some young talent sprinkled through, which isn't a bad recipe. I probably stopped short of saying they might get to the semi-finals of the World Cup, but like you say, they'll be going into it with momentum, and they'd certainly fancy their chances of maybe going one better than the traditional kind of Danish performance, which is reaching the last 16 and getting knocked out.
I feel enough time has passed for me to say, I'm not sure that was a penalty in the semi-final. I haven't said that
yet. No, it wasn't a penalty. Sorry, Denmark. It wasn't a penalty. I know we wasn't. Appealed for it. We did appeal for it. But we knew he hadn't edged it, put it that way. The batsman always knows.
You had your hand up, Johnny. Were you about to say something?
Well, I think one of the issues with this particular World Cup qualifying campaign is it's kind of been hard to get a handle on, because it was split in two. There was this whole, you know, preliminary bit before the Euros, which was just totally weird. You know, nobody, it was discombobulating. We were in the midst of Nations League stuff. We were in the midst of Euro build up, and obviously in the midst of like this huge global pandemic. And we've kind of emerged from it, and now, only now are we kind of getting a handle on all the kind of the stories and the narratives, and everything's kind of already been sorted out. England are through, France are through, Spain are pretty much through. I mean, Germany are pretty much through, Belgium are pretty much through, Italy are pretty much through. There's actually, you know, very few points of contention left in these qualifiers. I think Holland might be in trouble a little bit. By the time it's, you know, in the sort of six rounds it's taken us to actually start getting into these qualification games, they're kind of almost over.
Do you get the same feeling with the divisions in the Football League that your team isn't in? So obviously, like, last year I knew everything about League Two, but League One I didn't really pay any attention. And then like five games to go, I had no idea that they were then. Or is that just a sign of my lack of professionalism?
It can be both.
thank you, mate.
Johnny's totally right that because it's been divided effectively, it was easy to ignore beforehand. So I was kind of flitting through the tables last night, and you look around and you think, well, actually, this is all there's interesting stuff happening. The problem, I guess, is that, as Johnny says, there's, I don't know, half a dozen groups that are settled pretty much within a sort of reasonable expectation. And then there's quite a lot of really interesting battles for the second place, not least in England's group, funnily enough, where there's three teams that could all take it. The problem is that the point between coming second in your group and actually being in the World Cup is still quite an arduous process. So there's the whole playoff system, which involves semi-finals and finals. Only three end up getting through. So for the Scots, for example, they may well finish second, but then you'll have some pretty good teams knocking about, bolstered by various people out of the Nations League that I don't really understand. And they will be standing in their way in what's a reasonably sort of lottery-like situation. So it depends on who you get and whether you're drawn at home or away, and what, you know, what time in the other team's development you're running into them that separates you from the World Cup. So it can be hard to know anyway how seriously to take quite a lot of World Cup qualifying, because it may be that Scotland's result, and I don't want to pour cold water on the national team that I support, but Scotland's result in Austria might be brilliant, or it might be completely meaningless, because they run into a team who are much better than them in the semi-final qualifying stage and just get knocked out anyway.
Wales, disappointing draw for Wales home to Estonia. They created absolutely buckets of chances but couldn't score, which means they are level on points to the Czech Republic. They do have a game in hand, but as Rory said, all these things could be meaningless. Northern Ireland, 0-0 with Switzerland. Bailey Peacock-Farrell saved another penalty. Ben says, who is the greatest penalty saver of all time, and why is the answer Bailey Peacock-Farrell? Can anyone think of who's the best penalty saver? Is it Tim Krul, or is it
Diego Alves?
Okay, can we have some more information?
I've got Semir Handanovic.
Okay.
In my Google search, and Buffon just behind him, 38 penalties for Handanovic, 30 for Buffon, and 26 for Alves.
But didn't Handanovic play for about 75 years, isn't it? You know, just sort of.
Handanovic remains playing.
That's true. Who did you find, Rory?
My shout would always be Diego Alves, the former Brazil and Valencia goalkeeper, who saved. He had, at one point, he was saving one in every two. I think that was probably a hot streak that ended, but he was always the kind of the de facto best penalty saver in the world.
Elsewhere, Germany won 4-0 in Iceland. The Republic drew 1-1 at home to Serbia. It is worth finding their equalising goal, which had very little to do with any Irish players, which is slightly in keeping with Stephen Kenny's reign so far. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League weekend. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. This whole weekend seems to be surrounding about the Brazil players that won't be able to play. Schrodinger's cap says, would a pitch invasion where everyone's dressed as the Brazilian police be the ultimate shithousery this weekend? Generic football tweet, if Premier League teams playing their Brazilian internationals this weekend will receive a 3-0 defeat, shouldn't Liverpool and Leeds both play theirs so they both lose 3-0 and both win 3-0? Getting 3 points each. Premier League clubs remain hopeful of selecting Brazil internationals this weekend, despite being threatened with sanctions by FIFA and the escalating row over quarantine restrictions. FIFA have told Premier League clubs they cannot select players who were called up for Brazil's recent qualifiers but who didn't travel to a country that's on the UK's red list. So Alisson, Firmino, Rafinha would miss the Leeds-Liverpool game. Edison and Gabriel Jesus would miss City's game against Leicester. Chelsea lose Thiago Silva. Fred misses the Manchester United game against Newcastle. Richarlison can play for Everton because Brazil like Everton. Is that just because Everton was a Brazilian footballer? I think maybe it was. Also because Richarlison played every single game for every single possible Brazilian team during the summer. This is a sort of, Johnny, this is a pickle.
Yeah, it's got really, it's got not only very messy, but very rancorous, and it's got quite ugly. And you know, we all saw those kind of extraordinary scenes in the Brazil-Argentina game. And, you know, often these things sort of, these things brew under the surface, and, you know, you see headlines and you see various people, you know, making, you know, grand statements, but you don't actually think, you know, it's going to affect anything. You don't actually think anything's going to change. And part of me still thinks, you know, there's going to be some sort of, I don't know, people will have high level talks and there will be some last minute compromise and Fred will be allowed, Fred will be freed to play against Newcastle. But yeah, I mean, I think on a broader level, this is something that's been brewing for quite a while, you know, and it all stems from the fact that everybody has wanted a bigger slice of this post-COVID packed calendar than is probably reasonable or that they're probably entitled to. I mean, Premier League clubs want, you know, they wanted, you know, an inalienable right to have their players for, you know, whatever fixture they choose. And the, you know, international nations have been claiming the same right for years. And that was always going to run into, you know, in the current climate, this thicket of quarantine laws and border controls that is the world that we now live in. So this has been coming, and I think the fact that it has turned out like this is just a kind of a, I think it's a measure of the lack of trust and the lack of cooperation and basically disorganization in the global game at large. And that's something that is not going to be changed in a while.
Forgive me, are all the Argentinians, they're just on holiday in Dubrovnik, right? Is that where they are?
Spurs were on a kind of a international break, like a camp in Dubrovnik, and that's where I think Lo Celso and Romero have gone, I thought. So that's why they're there.
Well, that's nice, at least. It's a nice place to go.
Is it a Game of Thrones thing? Is that why they're there? Was there not some sort of plan that Martinez and Buendia would be shipwrecked on an island or something for 10 days, for 3 days.
For Channel 4, and then they'd bring in their ex-girlfriends, and then they would see if they get...
And Bear Grylls would arrive.
My understanding of it was that there would be a monster in the island, but also the island was the monster.
And they're all in purgatory.
And that it's actually an allegory for something. Johnny's totally right that it does kind of show the tension. I think it highlights a little bit the stupidity that football still has of everything. We can just do everything we want all of the time. It very clearly isn't sensible to be making players fly around the world for no apparent reason. Shut the door again. Hang on.
This is so exciting.
Rory's dog actually sounded like the monster from Lost just then.
Do you think that was a tradesman? Is that a tradesman?
It is. Can I drop out for a few minutes? Is that all right? And come back?
Yeah,
I'm really sorry.
What are you having done?
I will explain later.
Oh, well, okay. A leather room.
Whoa, intrigue.
it's not a leather room, I can assure you.
Look, it's been about 5 minutes, maybe 10 now, and Faye, Johnny and producer Ian and I have run out of small talk and we just want to get on with the pod. So we're going to get on with the pod. I can't remember what Rory was saying, but like, hopefully when he gets back, he can remember his train of thought. I want to move on to Ronaldo's comeback and the fact that, Faye, it's on at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. And as a result of that, there's been all sorts of conversations about the blackout and the fact that people won't be able to watch this game live on TV. And is that a disaster for viewers? Should they all be able to cope? I know as a lower league fan, I presume you have similar views to me about why that is important.
Yeah, it's really important. I think that because of the pandemic, we've been very, very spoilt over the last 18 months or so, in that every football match is available to watch, and there's only been, you know, one Premier League match perhaps at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. But it is important for lower league clubs, and I understand the argument that, you know, a big game with the reappearance of, you know, someone who was incredibly important to the Premier League era, is one of the best players in the world. I get that. However, what I don't agree with is, you know, lifting the watershed, because particularly at the moment, lower league clubs need the gate money more than ever before. And if everybody has just got, you know, comfortable with being able to sit at home and purely just watch Premier League matches, which, you know, think about young kids, for example, that's the exposure that they get all the time. They get exposure to Premier League football and don't necessarily engage with their local club as much, or they maybe have two teams or three teams like you, Max Rushton. You know, it's I just find sometimes people forget about the smaller clubs until there's a whole, you know, jump on the bandwagon of protect clubs, but then they forget about it when we're talking about a 3 p.m. watershed. I think it's important. I think it has to stay there. I get the argument that people want to see Ronaldo, but, you know, just be patient. And also, some of you, maybe you've got other things to do on a 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and you're not going to be sat down just watching Manchester United. It's not for everybody. Not everybody wants at 3 p.m. to sit and watch Cristiano Ronaldo take to the field for Manchester United. And I think those, you know, although some people think it's archaic, I think it's still important.
Would you like to hear my idea?
Love to.
I have an idea.
Oh yes, please.
Through this, but so basically, there's like two, I think, quite fallacious strands of thought that are running through this. The first is that, you know, football should be a big football occasion is something that everybody should be able to watch, which is the kind of argument that probably should have been made in about 1992, before they decided to sell off you know, the top flight fixtures to a pay broadcaster. The other one is that if you somehow paywall these games and take them off air, that A, people aren't going to try and find some way of watching them illegally, or that they're just going to, oh well, you know, never mind, I don't want to watch that anyway, I'm going to go and watch, you know, Barrow or Luton or Cambridge or whatever. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. So my idea was that you have the blackout, but it's an actual blackout. You know, it's not just a TV blackout. You don't have any football in the top two divisions between 2:30 and 5:30 on a Saturday, and that is grassroots football time. That's when you go and watch your local club, and in return, every game, you know, you can have two slots on a Friday, five slots on a Sunday, and the Premier League can sell off as many games as it wants, as long as it filters down some of that money to the grassroots teams and the local clubs, and they get that time slot on a Saturday afternoon, and it becomes a kind of a national thing. You know, this Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. is when you play or you go and watch your local club, and there's no football. You know, there's no Premier League football or Championship football to distract anyone. And, you know, it's not perfect, but that was my idea. And it won't happen.
I quite like it.
No, it's not a bad idea, actually. I mean, it won't happen. I think I'd quite like five Premier League games at 5 o'clock then, because I want match of the day. But that's quite a selfish view, because obviously you've got to think about those fans travelling and those kind of things. Like, I missed during the pandemic a good match of the day.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of sort of fans did that, you know, six Premier League games on Saturday or five or whatever, rather than just, oh, Gary hasn't got a lot to talk about this Saturday night. But look, as you say, no solution will be perfect, will it? And that wouldn't be about. Also, I quite like finishing playing on a Saturday and getting to the bar and then Soccer Saturday being on. But you know, you and I can keep brainstorming and we'll come to a perfect solution. But look, the idea that it would encourage anything to encourage people going, and I think what lots of people made the point that it isn't the season ticket holders of Stevenage or Rochdale, they will go. It's your sort of casual, you know, but actually football clubs have made their money on season tickets before the season started. It's the money that comes through of the casual, should we go? Yeah, here's 12 quid or whatever. That is the risk if they can go to a pub nearby and watch the three. I think we are agreed. It will be fascinating to see how this, you know, over time, you imagine at some point it will go.
But you can't protect domestic fruit growers by banning the avocado. People like guacamole. People aren't going to stop liking guacamole because you've banned the avocado. They're just going to find some way.
Johnny Lou, I love you. I love the way your brain works. It's marvelous.
Oh, well, eat apples and pears and no, I want guacamole. What am I going to dip my tortilla chips in? And I you're going to go and find some illegal guacamole somewhere. and who knows what's in that?
That's true. I like it. Illegal guacamole could be a great way for us. Dragons. Please invest. Rob says, any thoughts on Fylde's recruitment advert? Did you see this? If they tweeted it or it was on their website, I'm not sure. If not already apparent, we are not a Premiership club. Therefore, every penny and every fan has to be fought for and respected. You will need to be proactive in your approach to everything. We work hard at Fylde. So again, don't apply if you're looking for a work-life balance. Have to pick the kids up from school twice a week at 3:30. I like the idea of, I love the idea. I'm pretty much copying what Paul Hawksby said on TalkSport, but you know, I don't want a work-life balance. Here I am at 11:30 at night in the porter cabin in Fylde. What are they paying? What are they paying? Like £500,000? Like, do you have any interests outside of AFC Fylde? No, none. Good. Do you have any interest? Do you want to go to the cinema on Saturday? You can't. What about Sunday morning? No, you're not allowed. What can I do? Can I go on holiday in July? No, you can't. It's pre-season. We're planning pre-season on holiday. You can't. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's ridiculous. I mean, there is a serious side to it, isn't it?
You see these kind of things linked on social media every so often, like some club is advertising for a job as an analyst or, you know, the general manager or whatever, and it's full-time duties and they're either not paid or they pay travel expenses and you know, this is of a piece with that, you know, the idea that you just should be grateful to work in football and be treated, you know, however we see fit. You know, you kind of see that in journalism as well to an extent, that just you know, the point of being in proximity to this industry should be remuneration enough for you.
It's the fact that they've put in there that they think, you know, we want to protect the fans and everything, but you don't want to protect any potential employees or other human beings.
Anyway, Rory got some compliments, but since he hasn't come back, do you think we should? Owen said he's come to the conclusion, as a listener of many football podcasts, he does say Football Weekly is his favourite, that Rory Smith talks more sense about football than anyone else. And Red says, when Rory appears on BT Sports Score, my wife says, "Oh, the handsome man is on again." Is Rory actually handsome, or?
Yes. He does talk more sense than anyone else, but that's because he talks more than anyone else. He's kind of he's like
not
a,
at the moment, you know, he doesn't.
Well, not at the moment, but he's probably doing somebody. He's probably doing Five Live. He's probably, you know what he's doing. That was the bell. That was Ken off Second Captains going like, "Have you got 5 minutes, Rory? You know, you got to respect the hustle." You know, he does talk more sense.
Thanks so much for doing the whole podcast, Faye and Johnny. I appreciate it greatly. You know, because if everybody behaved like Rory Smith, then what would we be doing? It would just be like. I'd just be impersonating the head of AFC Fylde for 2 hours. Faye, thank you.
Welcome. Very welcome.
Thank you, Johnny.
Cheers, Max.
And in absentia, thank you, Rory Smith. It's very poor form. And if you could tweet Rory and just tell him how disappointed you are that he couldn't even be bothered because he's offering a tradesman a cup of tea. I bet. Do you know what I think the issue is? He said, "Do you want a cup of tea?" And then he's only got almond milk. And he's now in a sort of middle-class quandary. That's what I think he is. He's running, like a sitcom, he's running to the shop to just get some gold top. And then he'll get there and the plumber will say, "Actually, I wanted almond milk." You're presumptuous, Rory Smith. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.